Welcome to the Eastern Front. My name is Yulia Zsozsa. I'm with the Middle East Institute, Georgetown, and George Washington University, and I'm joined by my colleagues.
Giselle Donnelly, I'm a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and
Dalibor Rohach, also with AEI.
On our podcast, we talk about the many challenges to European peace that tend to emerge along a line running from the Baltic to the Black Sea, the Eastern Front, and about why those matter to the United States. If you enjoy this episode, please consider subscribing, rating, and reviewing us. Today, we're joined by Minna Olander, who is a research fellow at the Finnish Institute of Foreign Affairs, where she talks and writes all day about Nordic defense, NATO, and Germany. Minna, welcome back.
Thanks for having me again.
Absolutely. And I also want to mention two things before we get started. First, Minna is joining us by popular request from several of my current and former students from Georgetown. Every time I say the word Nordic, they say, Minna, we like Minna.
Wow, that's, I'm sure, totally honored, but nice to hear.
Yeah, you already have a bit of a fan club. We have to invite you over to Georgetown. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing, though it's adjacent to our topic, is that this week, Dalibor's country of origin and my country of origin and many others celebrate 20 years from what we call the Big Bang, 20 years in NATO. So a little shout out to that. And so Minna, I'm going to also ask you, how does it feel to be freshly in NATO? But before we get to that, I want to start us with a bit of a current event where I've seen some interesting exchanges of yours online. So I know you have opinions about that. And that is Macron's proposal to send troops to Ukraine. In my understanding, the utility of that is rather deterrence and trying to stop to draw red lines, right? But keeping it a little bit open and starting a little bit to be on the offensive. But it's a very controversial topic within Europe and within, obviously, the alliance. We see news and rumors about that emerging all day and every day. And I know that the Finnish Minister of Foreign Affairs has been on the side of supporting that, also quite controversially. So would you start there? How does Finland feel about this? What is the discussion within Finland as a brand new member and in the bigger conversation about European security?
I think that feelings are a bit mixed about this opening or the latest Macron statement. But what's interesting in this case is that it's not the usual him just like blurting out something and then his advisors at Elysee like really sweating and like getting some kind of a heart attack and then having to do some damage control. But this time it indeed seemed to be a position that had been previously discussed at Elysee, and it has sort of like a consensus in France. Like, I mean, not politically, obviously he got a lot of heat for it also domestically, but at least in his administration it seems that this was actually thought through this time. And I think in Finland, as I mentioned, the feelings are a little bit mixed because the way he went about it was not the best. I mean, well, fair enough, his hand was sort of forced in this press conference where he first mentioned it because it had been brought up by another minister earlier. But still, there was this sense that it was sort of like counterproductive to do it in such a fashion because it just sort of once again rather laid bare this European disunity, with Germany immediately reacting very heavily, sort of like emphasizing that this is definitely not at all like on the table and so on. But I think that what is viewed positively about it in Finland is, and as it is also in, for example, the Baltic states and Poland, is that this is definitely a much better Macron than 2 years ago in a way. We rather have this kind of dark Macron than the one who suggested that Russia should not be humiliated and that Russia should get some security guarantees instead of Ukraine. So I think that what is appreciated here is this kind of development that Macron is demonstrating right now, that he has really shifted his position in the past 2 years. It has been an incremental process. There were already signs of it a year ago, for example, at the GlobSec conference in Bratislava. He already like started clearly, he did this like some sort of a mea culpa about having missed opportunities to listen to the Eastern flank countries and so on. So obviously this comes from somewhere, you know, it's not just like uncoordinated blurting out this time. And I think this idea of reintroducing some strategic ambiguity and stopping this habit of constantly listing all the things that we're not going to do, I think that is sort of welcomed and appreciated.
Well, as you say, it was not exactly welcomed in Berlin, where the objects, if not of your affection, then of your attention, all reside. So I'd be really interested for you to just give us kind of a general update, if there is one, on your thoughts about where Chancellor Scholz and Germany more broadly are at this point. Do you see any prospect of movement in Berlin?
Well, unfortunately, yeah. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about this Zeitenwende that Germany is supposed to be doing. Well, I mean, I said 2 years ago, kind of jokingly, that like give it 10 years and it will happen. And unfortunately, this seems to be sort of an accurate assessment.
Oh, you think we're even behind that schedule? I don't know.
Well, I mean, now it's only been 2 years so far. It's just that Germany is not a fast country to change in this kind of an area. And that for a good reason as well. But what comes to this kind of like how Scholz reacted to Macron's statement and the resulting kind of open and public display of differences and even these like jabs at press conferences that were like flying in the weeks after, that was quite a low point, I would say, in terms of European internal diplomacy. And that was actually, from a Finnish perspective, that was like the most worrisome aspect of this whole situation, that Germany and France were so obviously so totally not aligned and not even trying to sort of hide it in any way and not talking to each other until the summit in Berlin, where then apparently the Polish president Tusk was sort of like in some sort of a mediating role or something. So that was very worrisome from a Finnish perspective, because obviously Germany and France still remain the most powerful countries within the EU, for example. And this just once again demonstrated how all of the European big three are sort of in their own ways unable of leadership or unable to lead Europe at the moment, in the sense that, well, the UK has currently quite a gap between ambitions and means because of the Brexit. So it's sort of like own bad policy decisions have led the UK to kind of, well, I mean, the UK chose to be out of it and now they are out of it. And like, you can't really lead from the outside very well. And then France is now, I think it's sort of like really laudable that Macron is now doing all this outreach towards the east and has changed his position. But I think the problem with France is a little bit that France wasn't so interested in the northeastern European countries for a very long time. So they still have quite a steep learning curve how to calibrate their messages. And then Germany, you asked about potential developments there. Well, unfortunately, at least in the chancellery, the position has remained extremely consistent in some negative ways, in the sense that Chancellor Scholz has had these principles that he has been repeating since the full-scale invasion, and those are that a NATO-Russia war must be avoided and Germany has to avoid doing anything that could make Germany a party to the conflict, and it remains at that. So there's this issue with Germany and its attempt at like responding to the expectations of leadership in Europe, that Germany is extremely risk adverse in its policy here, which is understandable in the light of German history. But the problem is that you can't really be a leader if you are not ready to tolerate any kind of risk. So there's then, of course, always this debate in Germany that, okay, they can't do certain things because they don't have nuclear weapons. So if France and UK can do certain things, then that's not possible for Germany. And I personally don't think that that's a very helpful or productive discussion to be had, especially openly, given that we're all supposed to be under the same nuclear umbrella in NATO. So there are a lot of issues there. But I mean, I could go on about Germany and the domestic political situation as well. There's like an election year coming in the eastern parts, regional elections, and it's looking very bad for the parties currently in power. Far-right party has been gaining in polls at a very uncomfortable speed. Plus that there's also a new sort of far left party that is also gaining. So the situation looks extremely difficult politically in the eastern parts of Germany. Germany with like both far right and far left gaining and both being sort of anti-Ukrainian and pro-Russian. So it's quite a complex headache that I imagine the German chancellor to have on a daily basis.
So I have a related question, because it strikes me that there is a real divide in Europe between countries, nations, governments that understand the Russian threat as existential and who believe that if Russia prevails in Ukraine, that it will almost inevitably be a guarantee of a future larger scale war that will involve other European countries, the Baltics, Nordics, Poland, etc., etc., and countries that just don't see it through the same lenses. Now, I'm going to play devil's advocate here and will sort of state an argument for complacency that I've heard from various circles, and I would love for you to demonstrate to us why that argument is false. Now, the argument that I've heard is that, look, Russia is, you know, throwing the kitchen sink at the war in Ukraine. They're doing what they can. They're suffering massive losses. Whatever the outcome of the war, Russia will emerge weakened out of this war, and it will take decades for Russia to rebuild its force, to constitute its military. We have therefore every reason to be relaxed about the future threat that Russia will pose to the continent. Tell us why that's wrong.
So that's so 2023, right? So yes, there was certainly this mood last year in many parts of Europe. And I think it was interesting to follow how the public discourse sort of went in these kinds of swings. That it started with a massive overestimation of the Russian capability and underestimation of Ukraine, which led to bad policy decisions, namely not supporting Ukraine enough beforehand. And then it started swinging into the other extreme, which was like looking at how Russia was failing on the battlefield and then concluding just what you said, namely that, okay, well, they're not going to threaten anyone for anytime soon. And I think both are sort of fallacies, because now, like this year, I think that at least in Europe, and this is interesting that even a country like France is now starting to get it. And we have to say that Macron has been sort of like a good ally for Putin for a while in some ways. And the fact that Russia has managed to antagonize even somebody like Macron just shows how Russia is always its own worst advocate. So what we have been seeing this year, and that has resulted in this like almost weekly announcements by either European countries, intelligence services, or top politicians that we have 3 to 5 or like sometimes only 1 year before it's gonna be a whole like all-out NATO-Russia war. There has been this reassessment of Russia's ability to reconstitute, and that is based on the fact that Russia has unfortunately been quite able to circumvent sanctions. They have had no trouble in building up a war economy of sorts. What is, I think, a very worrisome development is that now North Korea, Iran, China, and Russia are all kind of like working together openly. They're not trying to even hide it, because they have seen that it's okay, like they can do it and it will have no impact. And the West is not going to do anything directly against the ones or like anything else that they are anyways doing. So there's like no direct consequences of doing this. And because of these different things, and also because unfortunately the war is going better for Russia now in Ukraine, we are seeing different things happening, like at the Finnish border, this hybrid operation with the targeted migration. As soon as Russia had the capacity free sort of from Ukraine, they started with it. We had been expecting something like this to happen because it's a very low effort way to put pressure on neighbors. So kind of a classic in Russian toolbox. So we see that all of these things are happening, and they indicate that the war is going better for Russia, and therefore it can do these other things and start paying attention to other things again as well. So there's definitely no time for complacency. And my sense is that in Europe, this has really started to sinking this year. And why it took 2 years is a very good question. But maybe it's better late than never, if it's not too late already. So some things are happening. And on the other hand, we do have also different developments, like in the Nordic Baltic region, a lot has been happening throughout the 2 years of the war. So yeah, I think that this is literally sort of like a little bit last year's thinking, and that it's not so much a problem in many parts of Europe anymore at this point.
Yeah, you know, on your remark that better late than never was with a question mark behind it. It reminds me of my inner thoughts every now and then, or quite often. And I have to remind myself that, however, this is unprecedented compared to how we used to react and how much we used to mess things up. In this light, Europe is actually doing pretty well. But of course, we're here to criticize and try to do better. And so that brings me then to my question, and you already touched upon this, that Nordics overall, Nordics, Baltics, that kind of space is getting ready. And I'd love to hear from you how you're assessing this readiness overall, and not to ask you the question of why are they getting ready and others in Europe are not yet, or much slower, but rather to compare within the highest standard, which is now the Nordic region, how are they comparing? Who's getting readier? How are the threat assessments kind of evolving? And how are countries, if at all, coordinating? The region has been known for such a long time for having the highest levels of interoperability. But this is a whole new challenge. And for the first time, too, in this region, we don't have any more neutral countries, some countries that are in NATO and some that are in the European Union. Now, for the first time, everyone is in the same boat. So how do you think about how ready are they getting and what are the differences between them?
This is a really good question because, like, of course, as you say, this is a region that hurt the bullet, as they say in Germany, in a way. And there has been some serious efforts throughout the region, but there is some variation still. So Finland has been sort of in this situation that we just found our preparation culture, or like preparedness culture, just confirmed by all this. It's been sort of almost macabre to look at Ukraine and see that Russia is doing everything that we expected them to do or that they would do. And also that the more Russia changes, the more it seems to stay the same in some ways, and that it's always the same things that it does. So what happened in Finland was that immediately in the spring of 2022, there was a quick assessment of what are our obvious gaps right now. And where do we need to sort of like throw money quickly at? And that was, for example, ammunition, stockpiles and so on. So some procurement decisions were made immediately. And that currently has made Finland one of the very few countries in Europe that doesn't have the problem of empty warehouses. Quite the opposite, actually. So Finland has been able to fill the stockpiles to an extent that we actually need more warehouse space, actually also in the wider region. And this has been something that both the Baltic states and the Nordic countries have been doing together as well, especially the ammunition production. There are some companies that are co-owned by several Nordic countries with facilities all over the Nordic countries, and they have been working together, and also with this EU funding, which has maybe the best ever abbreviation, namely ASAP, Act in Support of Ammunition Production. So there has been several initiatives that have gotten funding, like partially from this EU common funding, and they have been scaling up their production several times over. Then there's some variation also among the Nordic countries. So Sweden has been in the process of building up its armed forces again after going all in on the peace dividend and basically scaling down very heavily after the Cold War. But this process sort of started already 10 years ago with first a 2013 Russian exercise during which they simulated a nuclear attack on Sweden, and Sweden didn't even have any planes or pilots in readiness to go scramble up and intercept the Russian planes because it was over Easter and everybody was on holidays and stuff. That was quite a shock for the Swedes. And from then on, and then the next year, the annexation of Crimea, those were kind of like the first wake-up calls. And now Sweden is really on quite a steep path into increasing their military capability. Conscription, like partial conscription, was reintroduced in 2017. And a lot of things have been happening there now. Just today, the Norwegian Armed Forces published their long-term development strategy, and it looks pretty ambitious. They're going to hit 3% defense spending of GDP sometime in the 2030s, and 2% the coming years, or was it already actually even this year? I didn't have time to read the whole report yet, just like the main things, but they are really also quite ambitious about their military buildup. Some question mark is still about Denmark. So they are now throwing just like massive amounts of money at the support for Ukraine. So Denmark is literally like absolutely leading even in the wider European comparison. I think they are only behind Germany and UK in their aid. Like, they filled several billion billions of euros at this point. So that is like a really notable contribution also. But apparently in Denmark, the domestic process has not yet quite gotten on to start investing also into the own armed forces. So we need to see about that. And the Baltic states, of course, their situation is a bit different because the Baltic states are so small, both in terms of population and territory, that it's sort of like impossible for them to defend fully on their own. But they've been also starting to cooperate more on especially joint procurement. They're now getting, for example, HIMARS together and building this Baltic defense line, basically like reinforcing the whole Baltic-Russian border together and other things like that. So that's also a very, very good development there. But of course, it's imperative for the Baltic states that NATO doesn't reduce any of the very hard fought for commitments that are now there in terms of what is, I think, now called Forward Land Force, previously known as Enhanced Forward Presence. So that's a little bit different, but there has been this very positive dynamic in the whole region and also like more cooperation between the Nordic and Baltic countries. So I'm sort of like cautiously optimistic about the readiness in this region, especially because there's been a lot of joint exercises and exercising together for many decades already. And I think that's one of the most important parts of joint readiness, that you have been also exercising the things that you need to do. So yeah, my glass is half full with regard to this region, at least.
A lot of this conversation focuses on questions of kit, equipment, industrial base, how much stuff we can get online, but obviously manpower and how you staff your military is an equally important question. And I think that's where Finland stands out with the size of its force and its in reserves. You alluded to Sweden reintroducing conscription in some shape or form. The United States obviously has a long-standing problem with recruiting people into the military. I think the UK has issues on that front as well. And I wonder to what extent there are lessons to be drawn from the Nordic experience. Your countryman, Field Marshal Mannerheim, said, and I quote, "Forts, cannons, and foreign aid will not help unless every man himself knows that he is the guard of his country." And so that's something that I think works quite well in societies that have a coherent view of the external threat and a degree of moral like-mindedness that I presume Finns and Swedes have to a greater extent than people living in bitterly divided and polarized societies. You know, like if you try to introduce conscription in a place like the United States, I think it would, you know, blow out to your face quite quickly. Or in my home country of Slovakia, I mean, people would go bonkers very, very, very quickly over that issue. So are there sort of useful lessons to be drawn from the Finnish experience, Swedish experience, or is it just sort of sui generis and just, you know, like we can't all be Nordics is the sort of lesson we should be walking away with?
This is actually a super hot topic right now in Germany because they are sort of planning to reintroduce some form of citizen duty, at least, like if not an all-out conscription, because that's sort of like not feasible in terms of capacity of the armed forces. But I would say that it is indeed a little bit difficult, especially the Finnish model is based on so many sort of unique and national characteristics and features that it would be very hard to import the system as it is anywhere. Even among the Nordic countries, there are some differences. In Finland, it's basically, on the one hand, it's sort of like a coin with two sides. On the one hand, on the negative side, there is the very deeply internalized and widely shared threat perception of Russia, and also which is based on like historical experience with that neighbor. And then on the positive side of the coin, there is this sense that Finland is a country worth defending. So that is something, of course, that in the absence of like such a clear threat environment Finland is located in, that is of course something that every country can try to be mindful of, like political leaderships, like is XYZ country, does it give ownership to its citizens, and like do people feel involved and like they can have a say in the development of the country? And this is on a quite high level in Finland. Obviously it's easier in smaller societies than large ones, but yeah, I think that conscription in general, I'm very skeptical about this German idea to bring it back, and I don't think that that's necessarily a good idea. I think it could be an overstretch, and sort of that they are also trying to maybe solve the wrong problems with it, or like that maybe the problem assessment is not quite correct, since Germany is now in such a different role within NATO, for example, than it used to be in the Cold War times. And also for the reasons that you mentioned, Dalibor, that if there is no social acceptance of the conscription, it can backfire very badly. So Norway and Sweden, for example, both have this kind of selective system where everybody gets called in, but then only part of each age class or cohort does the military service. service. The Baltic states have all also reintroduced conscription. Latvia was the latest one to do so last year. And I think this is a specific thing for countries with small populations, that it's mostly the best way to ensure that you have the necessary manpower for like territorial defense. And usually like small countries have small economies and limited resources. So that's, for example, one reason why Finland kept up this old school conscription system, because it's the best way to make sure, and a cost-effective way to make sure that you have the necessary manpower to cover all of the territory. Finland is actually quite large, but with a small population. Yeah, so professional forces are, of course, expensive to maintain. So in that sense, that works for some. But yeah, I think that the troop generation ability is a big issue all across Europe, because everybody went according to the NATO doctrine at the time for this small force, expeditionary type force for out of areas operations in the early 2000s. And once you have made that shift from a reserve-based force into a fully professional force, it's quite hard to bring it back, and it takes a long time, because at the beginning your human resources are limited, and then it takes time to train more training personnel at first, and so on and so on. So the personnel part is often the slowest to scale up in armed forces. But yeah, so I would say that like it probably works for like rather homogeneous small countries or societies. And you always have to sort of like ask yourself, do we need this? Is there any way that people will see the point in this? It always goes together also with the willingness to defend the country, which is very high in Finland, for example. And I think it's pretty high also in other Nordic countries and Estonia at least. So those are sort of like factors that take some time to figure out what is in this specific society the system that works best. And it's not always like a uniform answer.
Okay, we've gone a whole half hour without talking about the United States. But seriously, we're having terrible, terrible problems confronting or stepping up to our traditional role of leadership on the verge of yet again betraying the Ukrainians or an ally of ours. So I'd be interested, first of all, in your view of what you see coming out of the United States, how that affects Finland more broadly, and your perspective on how Europe is responding and would respond to a Trump candidacy or a Trump presidency, which could be quite catastrophic. So with that happy introduction, please give us a ray of sunshine.
Yes, here comes the ray of sunshine. It's sheer panic in Europe. Absolute panic. It's bad. I mean, again, just like I have to bring in an example from Germany, that after Trump made that 2% statement at the one rally that he would let Putin do whatever he wants with the countries who are not paying up, that triggered the good old European nuclear weapons discussion in Germany. I would say that it was not a serious discussion, but it was discussed seriously in a way whether Germany might be able to have its own nukes and stuff. So that was the level of panic that it induced in Europe.
Trump actually managed to create the term Eurobomb.
Yeah, Eurobomb. The one that would be like handed over, the big red button would be going around European capitals. This was the German idea. So from a Finnish perspective, all of this is incredibly unfortunate, because we have been recently hyping all the cooperation with the US so much, and like we just signed this DCA with the United States, and there's this huge enthusiasm about the cooperation, which has been really good so far, and the Americans have been incredibly present in Finland. There are all these incredibly funny videos of American soldiers having to do the polar plunge, which is basically that in your full gear you have to ski into a hole in the ice and then try to get out of it. So there's been a lot of fun footage from those winter exercises in Finland, and there's this sense like, okay, now we got all this covered, and there's this idea sort of that, okay, we have really good things going on in this region with like quite a good division of labor between the countries and everything, but we need the US to have the overview and be sort of the super glue that sticks it all together in a way. So obviously it will be a massive problem for everybody if the US indeed is out. But that's also the reason why, for example, in Finland, despite all this hype and despite all this excitement, there's also this realism that we can never put all our eggs into one basket. So that's why we have different arrangements, you know, like we have this small smaller NORDEFCO, the Nordic Defense Cooperation format. We have the British-led Joint Expeditionary Force, and then there's NATO, so that we have different levels to respond on, depending on the threat. And hoping, of course, that all of this will result in some form of a stable construct that will sort of keep us safe. But obviously, since the whole Euro-Atlantic alliance is built on the idea that the US is engaged in Europe, it's impossible to imagine how it would be without. And very obviously, everybody knows it, the European countries are far from ready for it if Trump indeed gets reelected. So yeah, it's looking very bleak. But I think it's so unfortunate what turns the discourse has taken in the US. Last summer when I was in DC for a bit, I got the sense that the Republican supporters of Ukraine were sort of like, they were still like behind Ukraine, but sort of like waiting to see some return on their investment, for example. And I've been wondering about this counterfactual, how different it could have been if we didn't first wait until the Russians could dig themselves in before giving Ukraine proper main battle tanks and stuff. Unfortunately, it remains a counterfactual and we'll never know. But I think that there's sort of a fallacy here, especially in this narrative in the US that it's actually China that the US needs to focus on. I think it's a completely fair argument, by the way, to say that the Europeans have to take responsibility for their own turf. And I think everybody agrees, like nobody in Europe says that that's unreasonable to ask for. But I think that there is this fallacy in this idea that the US can just somehow like focus on the Indo-Pacific and on the China challenge and ignore the Europeans, because NATO is one of the oldest in terms of treaty and international law, like one of the strongest commitments that the US has. So if there is doubts about the US commitment to NATO, like how credible is anything after that? That would have a serious credibility issue impact on the other global alliance commitments that the US has elsewhere. And we already see this, like the South Koreans are regularly freaking out a little bit, and there's sort of this mutual like freaking out both in Asia and in Europe that maybe one or the other is going to be sort of left out if the US focuses only on the other. And like, I don't know what the real interest of the people is who are saying America first, but then suggesting that Europe doesn't matter anymore, because I think that there is this credibility issue of any American commitments if it's not sure that America stays committed to NATO. So yeah, I guess that's how it looks. And it's not even necessarily about Ukraine. And I mean, you can make all these moral arguments that are completely obvious, but if you are a cynical person, there's more to it than just the moral argument of supporting Ukraine. And I think that it's sort of short-sighted to frame it this way in the US.
No, it is curious that self-styled realists don't see that the European balance of power is kind of important for global stability.
Yeah, and to me, you're speaking, Minna, to something that I think The Economist called prioritizers, China firsters, or a different name. You called it a fallacy, and I would call it even a fake, because obviously Taiwan doesn't need tanks, and you cannot expect to be a leader if you can't be managing more than one theater at a time. And none of these are commitments in terms of troops and manpower and all of that. So to me, that's just an excuse, and I don't think it's a matter of whether the United States chooses or has the luxury to choose. If we end up without one on one continent, we'll end up without the United States on the other one too. It's just an early sign of that.
On this podcast, David Frum came up with this metaphor of saying that abandoning Ukraine to focus on our alliances in Asia is a little bit like saying that in order to focus on repaying your mortgage and getting a better rate from your bank, you should just default on your credit card and then stop paying the electricity bills. You know, like I'm pretty sure that the bank would not find that reassuring, the same way Koreans and Japanese are not finding it reassuring that 2 years into this war, America is just sort of ready to walk away.
Yeah, and also what Yulia said, such a good point, that America doesn't really have the luxury of choosing whatever it feels like committing to at this point. There was maybe that luxury in the 40s, but America made some decisions back then. And now this whole kind of global alliance complex that the US has built since then, it's just way too complex and way too important to just like pick and choose which parts of it you want to focus on, because it's all also intertwined. joint. And if one part starts crumbling, then other parts will start crumbling and everything will have an impact on everything. So I'm just sometimes worried, like in terms of deterrence. I mean, obviously we have lost a lot of deterrence IQ since the Cold War. And some things also don't work the same way anymore because of recent developments in the 30 years. But still, I'm just sometimes like a little concerned about these US debates. Is it clear to everybody just how much depends on the US and the credibility of the US global commitments? I mean, we are already seeing what's happening, like what we just discussed briefly in the beginning with Iran, North Korea, China, and Russia working together openly now to keep Russia going in Ukraine. This is a direct impact of this incremental strategy that we have had in Ukraine. And I understand that, for example, the Biden administration and also the Scholz government, that they are very concerned about this potential for a nuclear world war. And that's like the escalation they're trying to avoid. But I think that they might be thinking in the old terms and not see what's already happening, that that's maybe not the most likely escalation to happen. But instead, we are already in the beginning of something that's more diffuse. And we may end up having sort of world wars, but not with big capital letters. We're more like here and there as a result when these countries, the rogues, kind of see that, okay, we can do these things and get away with it, especially if we have nukes.
You know, that's a really excellent point. Even if you start the clock in February 2022, there has been tremendous escalation. It's been horizontal, and it's not always been, some of it's been in Europe, but it's certainly been fighting in the Middle East has escalated, and the aggressive, you know, sort of boat bumping behavior of the Chinese military has likewise scaled up appreciably. The violations of Taiwanese airspace or Japanese airspace, so on and so forth. So, as you say, what the lesson that our adversaries have taken from the experience of the last several years is that you can actually get away with a lot of things, including basically full-scale war.
Yeah, and that's one, maybe just one point that I would like to add to that, that there's been a lot of discussion about, like, has the Russian nuclear threats, have they been working or not? And some say they have not been working because the West has not been deterred in the sense that they have helped Ukraine and so on. But on the other hand, there have been so many caveats, like this war would have gone so differently if Russia didn't have nuclear weapons. And if you're the Ayatollah of Iran and you look at this and you think, like, definitely worth having the nukes, because like you can do all kinds of things.
I'd like one of those, please. Yes, that's right.
Yeah, exactly. And so I would be surprised if we don't see some developments on the proliferation front in the next 10 years. So I think that these are the kind of escalation steps that are very likely to happen as a result of how this conflict has been managed. And obviously, because it's again a counterfactual, we will never know whether a different policy would have resulted in the Big Bang nuclear war or not. I personally think it's unlikely, but on the other hand, it's easy to say now that this is where we are.
I will end on these wise words from Mina Olander. Thank you for joining us, Mina.
Such a happy note, right?
Well, we can't do happy in these circumstances, but we can do wise. And this was a lot of food for thought. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
From me, Julia Zsozsa, and my friends,
Giselle Donnelly and
Dalit Burohaj.
Thank you for listening to the Eastern Front. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider subscribing, rating, and reviewing us. And to stay up to date with the Eastern Front, give us a follow on Twitter or X at Eastern Front Pod in one word, and sign up for a newsletter included in the show notes. You can find more episodes and additional content on our website, AAI.org, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. Thank you, and until next time, goodbye.